Welcome to Longevity. I'm your host, Natalie Nittam. I'm a nutritionist, a human potential and epigenetic coach, and I created this podcast to bring you the latest ways to take control of your health and longevity. We cover it all, from new technology and ancestral health practices to personalized interventions and a very special interest of mine, peptides and bioregulators. Enjoy the show. Hi, I'm Natalie Nittam, your host. Today's episode is a little bit different. Here we're doing a quarterly recap, pulling together some of the most impactful conversations we've had over the last 3 months, episodes that really push the needle on how we think about longevity. From rethinking weight loss through the lens of personalization and GLP-1s, to understanding why heart health issues often go unnoticed, to mitochondrial transplants to cure diseases, to how your body holds and uses trauma, and to the development of an amazing supplement that is simple yet does a fantastic job in some people of healing the depression, anxiety, and many other ailments that COVID may have left behind. Because the truth is, longevity just isn't about one breakthrough. You guys know this. It's about patterns. It's about connecting the dots across conversations and seeing how these insights start to stack. So in this episode, you'll hear some of the most important moments, biggest mindset shifts, and most actionable takeaways from the past few months. And if you're feeling inspired, you may just need to go back and listen to those full episodes. Now, we're going to thank a couple of sponsors that make this show possible, and then we're off. Question for you. Where does resilience actually come from? We talk about mindset, discipline, pushing through, but if your biology isn't backing you up, it's pretty hard to move forward. Now, over the past year, my resilience has definitely been tested in a few different ways. And one thing that became really clear is that energy is everything. If your cells can't produce energy efficiently, everything feels harder, physically, mentally, all of it. And this is why I'm so grateful to have my trusty Timeline gummies powered by MitoPure. MitoPure works by supporting a process called mitophagy, which helps your body clear out old damaged mitochondria and therefore replace them with healthier ones. So instead of just pushing through fatigue, you're actually upgrading the system underneath it. And this is not guesswork. Timeline has spent over 15 years and more than $50 million researching this with multiple human clinical trials behind it. If you're thinking about longevity and building real resilience, this is one of the most foundational places to start. Timeline's clinically proven formula is now available at a new lower price, starting at $99. And you can still get 20% off when you go to timeline.com/nat. What if the support your body needs didn't require another thing to wear, track, or remember? Even when we eat well and sleep enough, many of us still feel wired, tired, or oddly foggy. That's often a nervous system issue, not a motivation problem. Quantum Upgrade works quietly in the background, helping your system rebalance through quantum energy. You don't plug anything in, you don't download an app, you literally just stream it 24/7 while living your life. And what's really cool about it is you get to tweak it depending on what's happening in your life. So when I'm traveling, I use a certain setting. When I'm home, I use another one. If I'm working out, I'm going to look for a boost. If I'm feeling under the weather, we turn on the healing frequencies. It's pretty cool. And this is not about blocking EMFs, folks. Quantum Upgrade actually harmonizes it, transforming chaotic signals into coherent life-supporting frequencies. Among the 21 plus studies that have been done, live blood analysis studies show red and white blood cells visibly shifting within minutes of connection. And EEG brain studies show dramatic reductions in stress-related brain activity with improvements in HRV. Talk about a longevity strategy. And these are real measurable shifts, not just subjective feelings. You get to try it for yourself at quantumupgrade.io/nat. Use code NAT10, try the free trial, and see how your system responds. In episode 401, Ashley Koff breaks down why GLP-1s are not a standalone solution. Check out this clip. You're saying, look, a GLP-1 could be the thing for you. Mm-hmm. It may be the thing that you need, but guess what? If we just slap a GLP-1 on top of crappy digestion, poor nutrition, bad hormones, acid reflux, all the things you just said,
yeah,
you might get smaller, but you're sure as hell not going to get any healthier. And that's where we're seeing the fallout of everybody saying, well, look, you know, this person, they lost all their muscle and their bones turned into like dust.
Yeah.
And now they're worse off, which So can we just
And we have a great understanding of this if we look at diabetes. So I'm going to comment on another one because I really want people to take away that the medications, the set that we're talking about today, semaglutide, tirzepatide, that's the only, like, or liraglutide originally, that's the only ones I want us to reference for a moment. They're biosimilar hormone replacement therapy. So let's just look at, like, in, let's think of this. If you are a type 1 diabetic, we know that your body doesn't make insulin. So you will die unless you have insulin. And so we have, we thank goodness, we have synthetic bioidentical. So that's different, but we have a synthetic hormone replacement. So for that individual, they need it. They need it for the rest of their life. But they also eat and live their life to manage it. And there are some caveats or some people that are, you know, using other things. Like I just want to, but for the most part, for the broad strokes, this is what we're talking about. Then we have type 2 diabetics, and some type 2 diabetics actually do need insulin, and some type 2 diabetics use other medications, and some type 2 diabetics manage or even resolve their diabetes using diet, lifestyle, and, like, basically being able to figure out how to optimally resource the body, right? This is the exact same thing that is at play here with our weight health. There are, and when I went in and I looked at suboptimal function and I figured out how we can actually assess the function of these hormones, because remember, they only stay on for 2 to 5 minutes. We cannot do that with a lab test. So I created a clinical assessment. It's in the book. It is a lot, but you can go through it or you can go through it with a clinician and do that part. And when we look at that, some people, their function is completely, it's completely dysfunctional. So suboptimal has dysfunctional, delayed, or suppressed. And if it's dysfunctional, I don't know that we have the ability today to actually find out, do you just not make any of this hormone? But if it's so dysfunctional for you and your body's whole system, the whole ecosystem is demonstrating such suboptimal function, that we come in and we use this and we say, you know what, right now, let me start with a weight health hormone replacement for you, because it is going to help us help you make all those other choices, just like we do with insulin with a diabetic. But we also then talk to you about, hey, I'd rather that instead of apple juice, you eat the apple, or I'd rather that you, you know, don't have unprotected carbs and you have your apple with almond butter, or you, and we start to do the teaching, you know, and the stuff that maybe they even knew before, but didn't feel like it was possible, you know, we're able to do
that.
It wasn't working on that part. That's right.
You didn't have it to begin with. Like, you don't, if you're lacking the GLP-1 functionality in your body right out of the gate, that is part of the nothing is working problem.
That's exactly. And there's a genetic component. There's the, you know, like me, you're on antibiotics. There are all these other, you know, pieces. In delayed, it might be that your body's producing them, and it may be like a little bit of two things. It could be, you know, having a motion detector in a world where there's a stampede running in front of your motion detector is just, like, makes it difficult. Having a world where I don't have access to some of this, you know, two things that help me be healthier. Living in a body where I have, you know, a lot of earned trauma, and my vagus nerve function, you know, and some of these other pieces. So there may be reasons that there's a delay here. And in that person, maybe a lower amount, maybe starting on the agonist with a lower amount, or maybe using a supplement like, you know, an Amerisate or something where it's giving us, you know, a little bit higher amount of, like, maybe that's where we're going to be on that part. And for the person where it's suppressed, meaning that yours is operational, but your other choices are dampening, you know, I'm not sleeping, or I'm drinking alcohol, I'm doing other things, and I'm not, you know, able to let my hormones, you know, or I'm eating food that's not delicious to me, like, you know, whatever it is. In that person, I might say, I don't think you need this, you know? And what I will say is, I'm so happy for the medication, because those that are in the dysfunctional space right now with they are not dysfunctional. Their hormones are suboptimally dysfunctional. You know, that might be as much as 25% of the population. Okay. But we still have another 60 or 70% of the population that is in the delayed and in the suppressed. And if we have a conversation there that we only tee up a GLP-1 agonist as a solution, it's ridiculous in that part. Even in someone where it's dysfunctional, it is not the solution. It's the enabler for the personalized plan to work for them. And in somebody where it's suppressed or delayed, yes, you might experiment or you might benefit and you might use the agonist, but we absolutely have to do all the other optimizations, you know, on that part to help you build that more robust system. Because if we don't do it, we're not going to see the outcomes be like, I was kind of like laughing the other day. I don't know if this is going to sound bad. I'm not laughing at all. I want to be clear. I'm not laughing at all about anyone's hopefulness that GLP-1s could slow the progression of Alzheimer's. What I was laughing at was that the belief was, if we don't do anything else and we just put someone on an agonist, can we alone slow the progression of Alzheimer's? And in my, like, both of us are like, our brains are blowing up right now. And in that space, on the one hand, amazing things could be happening, because mm-hmm. if we're optimizing blood sugar regulation, if we're reducing inflammation, if we're helping somebody's brain actually be less saturated with food noise and with all these other things, what goes across the blood-brain barrier may actually be less problematic. But here's the other piece. If we're shrinking body fat, we're releasing a heck of a lot of toxins. Mm-hmm. And if the body isn't eliminating those toxins and isn't able to, and you know, we're slowing elimination, or we don't have optimized detoxification, that's not better. If we're not giving the body, to your point of building before, if we're not giving the body resolvins and glucoraphanin, or so, you know, what it needs to make sulforaphane to upregulate, you know, healthy blood-brain barrier and upregulate glutathione and all these other things, we're not promoting the body to repair itself from an Alzheimer's brain. So I think in that space where we are with these medications is, can we please throw away the messaging that they are one in thing. And of themselves a solution? Yeah. That's well, my soapbox.
In episode 414, Dr. Regina Drews speaks to us about many critical heart health strategies. Now, this episode, for some reason, didn't catch as many of your attention as I anticipated. And people, I really felt that this is really critical and free advice from a highly experienced integrative cardiologist. There aren't that many integrative cardiologists around. She has seen it all. So in this clip, she's breaking down how different kinds of fat actually impact our heart. So if you find this interesting and you want to learn more about Dr. Drews, make sure to check out the full episode. Ectopic and epicardial fat. Fat stored around the heart and organs. So people are starting to get their heads around this, right? We talk right. to it, speak to it very often as visceral fat, I think, certainly for the fat around the organs. So how do you explain what it is and why the heck it's so dangerous from a longevity perspective?
So great question. And, you know, maybe like these are almost medical terms. So let's educate people on what those medical terms are. So ectopic sort of means elsewhere, and epicardial means on top of cardium and, you know, your heart, right? Your cardium. And I talk a lot, you know, with my patients and in my book about something called sick fat disease. And that's what I want, you know, the listeners to remember, that sick fat disease is the inflammation of fat. And this is a newer concept, right? Because before we thought, well, you know, people, they start to pile on that fat internally in between the organs, you know, that's your visceral fat, you know, in the organs, that's your fatty infiltration, for example, liver fatty infiltration. And of course, that damages the organs if there's too much of it, because they're just not functioning properly. But now we also know that the reason for that damage is that it creates these areas of inflammation locally. And that's how the damage happens. So there is an inflammatory, there's an inflammatory phenomena happening. And what we started to understand with regard to heart disease, for example, and you know, heart disease is not just coronary artery disease. Heart disease could also be structural. Valve disease, for example. Heart disease could be electrical, like atrial fibrillation, right? A very common arrhythmia. So what we've begun to, and of course, heart disease, a big part of structural heart disease is heart failure, which is one of the most devastating types of heart disease, very much on the rise, especially in women. And that specific type of heart failure that's on the rise in women, so-called obesity phenotype heart failure, is very difficult to treat, because the kind of mainstay medications for heart failure, the older medications, were for a different type, right? So what we learned from some of the recent literature is that there is fat infiltration of the heart muscle. There is fat that surrounds the coronary arteries. This fat is not inert. This fat actually is sick. And so sick fat disease, you know, because this fat secretes a variety of inflammatory mediators that lead to critical inflammation, whether it's in coronary arteries or in the heart muscle itself. Inflammation leads to plaque progression, leads to fibrosis. And so we see these clinical phenomena emerge. And this is one of the reasons why I actually changed my opinion on, GLPs and GIPs, the medications that are basically making pharmaceutical manufacturers richer than ever, right?
So you call them GLPs and GIPs, just for the audience. These are GLPs and GIPs. These are the peptides of the decade at this point.
The peptides of the decade. And so, or the peptides of millennium. But, so I changed my opinion on these medications because the clinical trials have started to report that there are effects which are independent of weight loss. And these effects are due to anti-inflammatory properties of these medications, including their ability to turn off the inflammation in that ectopic or epicardial fat.
And does it reduce the ectopic and epicardial fat as well?
Some earlier studies using cardiac imaging techniques have started to show that. So the point is that, I sort of changed my mind on this because I said, well, this isn't just about weight loss, although weight loss is certainly, part of it has its benefits. But, as cardiologists and a lot of longevity physicians will tell you that, weight loss in and of itself is not enough to reverse a lot of cardiac conditions or even cardiac risk factors, right? So it's just not a magic bullet that people think it is. Again, it's sort of the example of that linear thinking. If I lose weight, I'm going to be better. For some people, it works very well, and for other people, not so much. Yeah. But what we find is that these medications appear to have other effects that are more powerful than weight loss, and that's silencing or turning off the visceral and, inflammation and inflammation, which is vascular inflammation, which is in that, fat tissue, that sick fat tissue. So that's the properties that, are responsible for a lot of their effects.
That's unbelievable. I also think that fat loss, losing excess fat, and we're not talking necessarily the last 10 pounds, but if it can help to resolve sleep apnea, if it can help to resolve blood pressure, if it, the satellite benefits of those things, I think is what can pay off in huge dividends. But this lowering and reducing inflammation is going to be a massive piece of the puzzle. I want to get into women and menopause and those particularities. Okay. I think that one of the ideas that maybe you talk about is that menopause doesn't create new risk factors. It amplifies the ones that are already there, which I don't think is something that is commonly talked about. Mm-hmm. So what does that mean in practical terms for blood pressure, lipids, and fat distribution? Basically, I guess as women are coming into menopause, is there anything we should be aware of, or how is this all playing out from what you're seeing?
It's basically exactly what you said, right? So women that we know that menopause is going to change metabolism, it's going to change vascular reactivity, it's going to change sleep, it's going to change body distribution or body fat distribution to be exact. And of course, menopause, unfortunately, is the time of increased inflammation and stress on cardiovascular system. So if women come into that menopausal transition already with pre-existing cardiovascular risk factors, metabolic dysfunction, poorly controlled blood pressure, obesity, or high concentration of that visceral or sick fat, these will, of course, worsen with menopausal transition, not the other way around. Yeah. And, the belief that just sprinkling hormones on it will reverse it is not true.
No. So, okay, here's another one. Many women are told that their symptoms are atypical or it's anxiety driven. When you're listening to a midlife woman describing chest discomfort, palpitations, or exhaustion, what are the red flags that make you say, this is cardiac until proven otherwise, versus the current, which is, that's just anxiety, and don't even look at a possibility that it's cardiac?
Simple answer here. She is reporting these symptoms. This is cardiac until proven otherwise. No, that's that. There is nothing that's going nothing else to do. Nothing else to do because we have great testing. It's not invasive. We can have an answer super quick, and even if it's not something sinister like a heart attack, and hopefully it's not, we could give an individual important things that they need to know about themselves to make sure that they don't have a heart attack.
Yeah, I love it. Where do you see hormone therapy, lifestyle medicine, and cardiology needing to talk to each other more intelligently if we're serious about protecting women's hearts and their longevity?
Another great question. So years ago, when I was speaking at the American College of Cardiology, I was in the little lounge area for the faculty, and one of the very well-known esteemed women cardiologists, who was somebody that we all looked up to, told me that just asking about hormone therapy is malpractice. So I think that we've come a long way since then. I do think that there are pros and cons to the recent FDA removal of black box warning, because hopefully it will open the door to an informed discussion and personalized management, because appropriately started hormones, when additionally women's risk, metabolic risk, and inflammation risk is managed as well, could definitely make an impact, clinical impact. I think the downside might be that women will rush into hormone therapy without recognizing the fact that it is not a magical solution. And I see a lot of the women like this, whose lipid markers, metabolic markers, continue to be misaligned with the degree of hormonal therapy. So hormonal therapy needs to be individualized.
Yeah, it's like everything else, though. I mean, like you said, it's not a silver bullet, but it's part of the puzzle. So
exactly.
So I mean, I think I know the answer to this question, but should all women consider getting some kind of cardiac checkup at some point? And what age do you think, like when should we start to look at it? Do we wait for menopause? Do we do it ahead of menopause? Like, what do you think? And
I think the answer is yes. I think the same paradigm that we use for breast cancer screening, with examinations that start in a certain time frame and continue annually, will be something that we will need if we want to get ahead of cardiovascular disease in women. The question of when is an interesting question, because I answer a lot of these questions based on genetic and laboratory markers, right? You could have a 25-year-old whose genetic and laboratory markers are very worrisome, or a 55-year-old where they're not, and you're more worried about sort of age-related progression of cardiovascular disease. So this is something that we will find out. But as a rule of thumb, you know, I would absolutely say that any woman who is considering having children or had children, especially young children, needs to know her cardiovascular risk, because she wants to be there for her children and for her family. Yeah. And that's the time when it's going to be most challenging for her to actually mitigate the factors that down the line will accelerate that vascular aging.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think we all aged through early childhood years.
Yeah.
Lack of sleep, stress, not taking care of ourselves. Right. Hopefully we mitigate it down the road. But yeah, I mean, I think the concept of getting a baseline earlier in the in the game, like maybe you don't need to be checked as often, but to have a baseline of what your normal is, and then if anything comes up, start to increase the number of times you look at these things would make sense.
This clip from episode 419 is where Dr. Natalie Yevgi Ohana completely blows my mind as she explains that a mitochondrial transplant can heal rare diseases. And beyond that, as the therapy becomes more widely known, it could potentially cure a lot more illness, including aging.
My aha moment was, can we use mitochondria to fix diseases? Can I isolate mitochondria from one cell type and apply it to another diseased cells? Will they go in like they did during evolution? And that's it. That's how Minovia started. It was a crazy idea, but I just had to test it. And it was true.
So what was that scientist's name you said in the 1960s? And who didn't publish her paper? And who ended up, was it a guy?
So Lynn Margulis was a scientist in the 1960s. And she suggested the fact that there were endosymbiosis happening between different species. It is also the chloroplasts inside plant cells, which are also evolutionary. They used to be also germs, and the mitochondria in our living cells. So she suggested that there is a structure that enforces these two species to come together in order to supplement a missing function. That missing function was the use of oxygen. And the outcome was the creation of the energy, the ATP. She tried to publish this in 15 different journals, and she was rejected. In the 16th time, that was accepted. And eventually, it's a common practice for everyone. This is the endosymbiotic theory. When you look at the mitochondria under the microscope, they look like bacteria. They are the size of bacteria. They contain their own DNA, just like bacteria, and their DNA is circular, just like a bacterial DNA. So everything about them says that they used to be bacteria. They actually can replicate independently from the cells multiplying. They can just...
they do the...
Fission and fusion and mitobiogenesis, and they're very independent within the cell. We feel very brave now. First of all, our therapy is safe, so it's not do no harm, first of all. And
first of
then
all, yeah.
Seeing the multi-organ improvement, we had a patient with severe epilepsy and stroke-like episodes on a monthly basis that for 6 years we prevented those after a single treatment. It was like unbelievable.
Wow.
So we really try to understand how to deliver this therapy way broader. The brain is a very interesting but very challenging organ system. Mm-hmm. We will just have to face the clinical outcomes, see them, and eventually that will be the proof. I don't think we'll ever understand everything about how it's exactly working. But I think that's the most important thing, because if you save the life of a child with a Pearson syndrome, but you didn't fix his brain, I mean, that's...
You didn't achieve the ultimate goal. So we can say that metabolic disease, like diabetes, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, cardiovascular diseases, are going to, at the very minimum, have a mitochondrial component to them, if not be foundationally linked to mitochondrial malfunction or underperformance. Are we misclassifying diseases that are actually mitochondrial in origin? I mean, fundamentally, the question is, do you think there's a disease that isn't founded in mitochondrial dysfunction?
I would do this.
In some way?
You can try and search in any search engine, any disease with mitochondria, you will find a connection. I tried this before. You can go ahead and do that. But definitely, I mean, whether it started the disease or it's an outcome, this is a question. What I can tell you for certain, any disease will benefit from improved mitochondrial function. Okay, so that's because fundamentally, if you get more energy, you can fix anything within the cell. Yeah. Talk about, you spoke about diabetes. Insulin production is an energetic process. It has to be coming with improved mitochondrial function, and then you'll get more insulin production, controlling of insulin production, controlling of glucose metabolism. All of that is energy dependent, and mitochondrial dysfunction will actually induce further damage into these cells. If you improve that, you have a better chances to fix even the initial problem that the cell has.
Yeah, 100%.
The cell accumulates mutations, for example, and now you improve mitochondrial function, you have better chances to initiate a DNA damage response or to improve the function of those machineries that will fix the cell. And if it's not, mitochondria will induce the apoptosis, the cell suicide, to remove and eliminate the bad cells, which is also fundamental. So, I think there is even... I tried it, even one disease that doesn't have mitochondrial function eventually. And those diseases will probably benefit from mitochondrial function, yes.
Yeah, I would think so. Even like anything in the eyes, like as we see the decline in the eyes, like the eyes are so dense in mitochondria.
Just before our call, I had a full discussion about the different diseases that could benefit from mitochondrial transplantations. You name it.
All right, let's move into mitochondrial biomarkers, measuring the invisible. So this is what your work really becomes also about. Like there's obviously the mitochondrial transplantation, but as you said, in order to quantify what you're doing and to understand the needs and the outcomes. It's really about measuring something that nobody really has been able to directly measure so far.
Let's face it, most detoxes are just an expensive way to feel horrible for a week. Why? Because they often force toxins out with laxatives and harsh ingredients, resulting in cramps, deep fatigue, and days of discomfort. Just Thrive Daily Gut Detox is different because it works with your body, not against it. Daily Gut Detox is powered by clinically proven immunoglobulins that act like a toxin magnet, binding to the bad guys in your gut and then safely carrying them out. No extreme flushing or cramping, no shock to your system. And because Daily Gut Detox is gentle enough for everyday use, your immune system, gut barrier, and digestion get the support they need to stay strong and healthy. So if you're dealing with signs of toxin buildup, like embarrassing bloat, brain fog, little fatigue maybe, now you finally have a science-backed detox tool that's easy to stick with long-term. Daily Gut Detox is microbiologist-formulated, gluten-free, dairy-free, and non-GMO. Ticks all the boxes. And you can try it risk-free with Just Thrive's 100% money-back guarantee. Visit justthrivehealth.com/nat20 and use code nat20 at checkout for 20% off your order. Now check out this clip from episode 421, where Dr. Amy Apigian explains what our bodies do with stored trauma and long-term stress. This was literally one of my favorite episodes.
How the body goes into a trauma response is the same way that it then comes out.
Okay.
And I say that because most people think, I just want to go do that ketamine journey. Mm. I just want to do the ayahuasca. And not realizing that that belongs in a certain phase, but that's not phase one.
Mm-hmm.
So there are three phases of this healing journey because we have to walk our body from where it's at to where we want it to be.
Right.
And it's not a shortcut. There is no way to make that jump without going through the anxiety and the grief and the panic that are all stored in our body because we didn't ever resolve it at that time.
Okay. Because you do talk about, and I just at this juncture, you talk about some types of therapy just re-traumatize the person.
Totally.
So how do you avoid, like, what's the difference in approach between what you're talking about versus just reliving the freaking trauma and being just as traumatized as you were before and going, great, now I know, I've seen it, I've lived it again. Now what? I don't feel any better.
So if we really come back to our definition of trauma and say trauma is our body going into a trauma response, then if that's what I'm trying to avoid, I'm trying to avoid overwhelm.
Right.
I'm trying to avoid overwhelming my mitochondria, overwhelming my immune system, overwhelming my actual cells.
Yeah.
That's what I'm trying to avoid overwhelming. And as we were talking before, it doesn't always give us the memo ahead of time.
It truly really sucks. You know, life would be so much easier if you got a heads up.
Which means that we often need to go slower than what we think we need to go just to make sure that we don't overwhelm our body systems that aren't going to give us that message ahead of time.
Yeah.
And so I liken it to a swimming pool. Where yes, I can say where we want to be is we want to be swimming and splashing and playing in the deep end of the pool. That's where everybody has the most fun. Mm-hmm. That's where we're the most alive. So I'm going to throw you into the deep end of the pool because that's where you want to be. That would create overwhelm. Yes, that is where we want to be.
Yeah.
However, where we need to start to prevent overwhelming our body is we need to start in the shallow end of the pool.
Mm-hmm.
And then we need to even get our body to say, oh, water isn't dangerous because it's had that experience that water is dangerous. And then I teach you how to swim. And I teach you how to swim in the area of the pool where you could just stand up at any point to stay out of overwhelm.
Right.
And then we get to the deep end of the pool.
Yeah.
But again, many people not knowing this is what I did. I didn't know better. I'm like, I need to process my stories and my past, apparently. Let's jump in and get this done.
Yeah. Well, I got no time. Yeah. Let's.
I don't have time. Yeah. Right. Exactly. Yeah. See, yeah. You get me, Natalie. You get me.
I
jump in the deep into the pool and I'm drowning in my own emotions. Mm. I don't know how to feel this anger. I don't know how to feel this grief. And so I'm back to my usual coping mechanisms of laying on my couch, watching a movie, hugging a tub of ice cream. Because I'm numbing. I'm having to numb these feelings because I don't know how to swim yet.
Yeah.
And yet in the process of trying to heal my trauma, I'm actually reinforcing those very same responses that I'm trying to change.
Right.
And you know, with neuroplasticity, whatever you reinforce gets wired in even deeper.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so that's why these methods that are going to overwhelm us are not helpful. We have got to even learn that doing it gentle is part of the rewiring.
Yeah.
Treating ourselves with kindness is part of the reprogramming that has to happen, because that is actually part of our trauma patterns, is pushing ourselves.
Yeah, and beating ourselves up. And there was one exercise I read about in the book. I mean, I haven't finished it yet. So, but there was one exercise you describe, which is, you know, it's art therapy, right? But yeah. What really struck me about it, where you encourage people to draw out these scenarios, it's separating your today from your person from before, right?
Totally.
Speaking about yourself in the third person.
Third person.
Right? So creating, so somatically by drawing it, I guess, and emotionally by speaking it, and all the different strategies that you use, is really to separate that traumatized person or that person that's being traumatized from the person that you are today, which I found so, I just found that so powerful, right? Because I think any of us, if there have been a couple of fairly traumatic events in my life, and if I go back and talk about them, my heart rate will go up. I'll get flushed. I go, and I'm like, dude, like this was a decade, like get over it. You're fine. It's, you got through it. And yet my physiologically, I feel it if I'm telling the story. So I guess I haven't separated myself from it yet, but it is, it's, you know, as I'm reading the book, I'm like, wow, really? No. but tell me this, like, does the body decide what system, how does it just like for, you know, for me, I've decided, and I guess, and for you, the immune system is where it lives, your trauma, right? And that's the system, therefore, that expresses the overwhelm, the lack of capacity when you overpush. Is it always the immune system, or can it be different systems in the body?
There tends to be a predominant system for each person. But Natalie, chapter 5 of the book shows that every single system is affected.
Okay. So it could be cardiac, it could be the heart, it could be whatever. Yeah.
Exactly. You and I both know people that when it comes time for their family reunion, they're breaking out in the skin rash. Right. But for other people, it's their digestive system.
Right.
That's been a big one for me. So for me, my primary has been both my digestive system and my immune system. I've got my immune system. Well, I mean, just as I say that, I can think of many examples just this year where, no, I reached a critical line of anxiety, panic, and now overwhelm. And there was my immune system getting sick.
What starts to shift in the body when you do this work, right? And you start to move your biology from this constant survival state into repair and restoration. Like, do we feel that? Or is it just that we start to have more capacity? You start to notice that things don't affect you as much. You don't get sick as often. You don't have an immune flares. Like, is it literally that direct?
It literally is that direct.
Wow.
The first things that people experience when they work with me in the first 3 weeks, they have improved sleep scores. They have improved digestive system. They have less digestive issues when they go to eat. They have less anxiety. They have less depression. They have more sense of community and joy, and a 60% increase in a felt sense of safety.
Wow.
And that's just in the first 21 days.
That's amazing.
So you take that and now you extrapolate that for the next 3 months. If you feel 60% more safe in your body, well, what else is going to change?
Many people are unknowingly living in a chronic survival state. Like they don't realize it, but all they're doing is surviving, right? How does that reshape the nervous system over decades? Like what's the impact on your nervous system when you're constantly pushing, like just living in that, I'm not going to die, but I'm going to die kind of scenario?
Yes. Now, chronic stress is one of the biggest misnomers that has hurt us in the medical field.
Yeah.
We've labeled things as stress, and stress is bad. We need to reduce stress. We need to manage stress. And then there's chronic stress, and that's really bad.
Well, that's totally going to kill you. Yeah.
And yet,
stress didn't kill you. The chronic stress is taking you out.
Right, exactly. Yeah. When we come to the physiology, Natalie, we see that there's not that distinction in the body.
Okay, well,
there's not this
talk about that.
Chronic stress state. Now, that actually comes from a stress researcher. His name was Dr. Hans Selye, and he gave us the model of chronic stress. But what he was actually describing without having the words to describe it was that shift between stress physiology and then overwhelm.
Okay, so let's make that distinction, because I think where people are going to push back on this and they're going to say, yeah, but you know, when you're chronically stressed, your cortisol is elevated, you're in a catabolic state, your blood sugar is going to be high. You know what I mean? Like this, these are the definitions we've put around chronic stress. So let's peel that apart a little bit.
Absolutely. So what he noticed was that people could be in this acute response state. Acute response state runs on adrenaline.
Right.
Adrenaline, its job is to help all your cells in your body make more energy and then use up that energy for self-defense or expansion, growth, whatever it is. And then he noticed that a line would be crossed. And he noticed that what happened in their physiology was what he labeled exhaustion phase.
Mm.
The body is exhausted and no longer is it able to do what it did in the acute response phase. Now, because it's exhausted, it starts to fall apart. So now we have this inflammation.
Mm-hmm.
In the acute stress response, we don't have that kind of inflammation. We have an acute response inflammatory state, but it doesn't look anything like the exhaustion phase inflammation.
Right.
So even that is very different. And what he just didn't realize was that that exhaustion phase was not just chronic stress. It's different than stress. And he acknowledged that. He just didn't have any other words to use for it. So it got labeled as this is stress and this is chronic stress. But actually what's happening is that the body is reaching an overwhelm state when it crosses that line. And when it crosses that line, it does not matter how much adrenaline you have. It does not matter how much cortisol you have, because what's shifting is your nervous system state.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like shifting from driving your car in sixth gear because you're racing somewhere to throwing on the emergency brake.
Right.
You can still have your foot on the gas pedal. It kind of doesn't matter because you have the emergency brake on. And that is often why we see high cortisol, not because cortisol is actually causing all of these problems, but because the emergency brake is on. And so the body's like, hey, we're trying to create a different response. And so we're giving you all of this. Cortisol is actually supposed to be there to help buffer us from adrenaline.
Okay.
Cortisol isn't bad.
No.
But again, what we've identified as, but high cortisol means this, but that's only because high cortisol is still there in these conditions. High cortisol is not necessarily causing that. What's causing that is this vagus nerve system shift.
Right.
And so that's where the focus needs to be, is how are we helping our vagus nerve take off the emergency brake so that our body can come out of this chronic exhaustion phase and move towards healing. But see, Natalie, most people don't even know that. Most people don't know that the vagus nerve can also communicate overwhelm and trauma. They've only heard the vagus nerve is great. You want to activate your vagus nerve. You want to stimulate your vagus nerve. And we've got all these devices and breathing techniques and
humming,
cold plunges and biohacking because vagus nerve is only good. No, the vagus nerve is just the train tracks.
Yeah.
It's a nerve.
Mm-hmm.
A nerve is just train tracks. What is the train that's running down those train tracks? And you have two different trains that can run down the vagus nerve. You can have the ventral vagal, parasympathetic, rest and digest. I call it calm and yet alive. You can have that train run down your vagus nerve. And that is when everyone, no matter what health conditions they have had, will be in their best health and their best self. But then you can have this other train. And this is the train that runs down the vagus nerve when we reach a point where the life threat that we feel is in front of us is so big, we think we might die. It's that moment of feeling trapped, powerless, and yet my life is in danger, or it feels that it's in danger. By the time we reach adulthood, Natalie, honestly, the most times that we are going into this overwhelm response is in interpersonal relationships.
Yeah. Yeah.
And yet interpersonal relationships is where we feel like it's a life threat. I'm going to die if you abandon me. I'm going to die if you don't love me anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the bear. It's not the lion.
No.
For us, especially as adults, it goes all the way back to our early adult, early life and attachment issues. But most of the life threats that we perceive are interpersonal.
Yeah. And it's about getting kicked out of the tribe.
It's about getting kicked out of the tribe.
Right? Like it's ultimately because we can't, we're not solitary creatures.
Never intended to be solitary.
No. And as a little child, if you learn that anger is bad and makes you bad and therefore you will be excised, you carry that through your life.
Yes. And so now when you feel angry, you are going to not only stuff it inside because there's no way that you can express your anger, but you are going to say, this is a life threat to feel this way.
Mm-hmm.
And so much of autoimmunity is I am the problem. I cannot feel this way. I need to shut this down. I need to shut myself down.
Interesting.
All of autoimmunity has attachment patterns behind it. It's fascinating.
It is fascinating. It's crazy, actually. And so when people stay in that chronic survival state that you've described, does that have, like, what is the impact on that on the nervous system over their lifespan if they don't address it? You know what I mean? Like, how does the nervous system, does it just get exhausted? Is it tapped out, loses capacity? Like, what's the impact on the nervous system?
It is very predictable and consistent. And so what happens is that when we've had an experience of overwhelm, this feeling powerless, trapped, overwhelmed, if we don't have the full recovery, if we don't have that full reset to safety, our body stays thinking we're still in danger.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what most people think is that I stay always hypervigilant. I stay always stressed out. But actually what happens is that the body enters into this loop and it's looping between those last two steps of the stress and trauma response. So sometimes it's in stress and we're waiting for the next shoe to drop. We're super sensitive. Our nervous system is on edge.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes our nervous system says, I'm exhausted. I can't keep up with this. And it's falling into that overwhelm. It's crossing the line. And it does that, Natalie, to get some relief.
So it's shutting down. Like you're exhausted. You can't deal. You can't cope.
This is when you're also going to start emotionally eating, eating those things that you don't want to be eating, but yet your nervous system has to find relief from the constant sense of danger and bracing. But to do that, since truly feeling safe is not an option, the next best strategy is just to numb it.
Right. Right. Right.
And so we avoid, we distract, we numb, and there are all kinds of coping mechanisms that humans come up with.
In episode 417, Dr. Cynthia Keller shares how COVID in many people left behind total wreckage for our health and mental well-being, and the amazing yet simple tool that she developed to help get some patients right back on track.
I had a patient who was suicidal, and I've known her since birth. She wasn't supposed to be suicidal. She should have been panicked, right? Because that's who she is. And I was like, well, when did this start? Because I was so confused. And usually I've intervened before they're suicidal, you know, like,
yeah. Well, there have been signs and symptoms. Yeah,
right. We talk about that. Right. And we find solutions. So, she said August 25th. And I was like, what?
Whoa.
And she said, yeah, I was at the fair and I realized if I can't be happy here, then I might as well just end it. And like her life was great. There was like no thing. Later, I figured out that she had had COVID. I think it was August 18th. Then I went, well, that's weird, right? So for about, it was almost a year, maybe 9 months, I treated her with medication after medication because I'm good at that too. I don't love medication, but I really don't like kids who are suicidal. So it's always about picking the best choice. And then I was at a conference and I hadn't solved it. Like she wasn't actively suicidal, but she wasn't happy. I still was seeing her regularly. And because I had to solve it, right? So then I'm at a conference and it was about COVID, but it was about how COVID hits this, or there's three receptors for COVID in the gut. And that cell is called the enterochromaffin cell. And its job is to take tryptophan and turn it into serotonin in the gut, not in the brain, to like move things along, you know, propulsion, so that the virus leaves and some other things. And all of a sudden I thought, huh. And then I thought, well, maybe this is a serotonin thing. Maybe that's what's up with her. And then I went, oh, but, and like 90 to 95% of the serotonin in the body is made by those cells in the gut. So then I'm like, yeah. Oh, this is it. And then I remembered, wait, like serotonin doesn't get into the brain, right? Like tryptophan has to get into the brain. So you take tryptophan in, about 1% of that gets into the brain. And that you can use to make serotonin for, you know,
for the brain,
for moods. Right. So then I was like, huh, well, if COVID keeps removing it, right, then like maybe 1% of less tryptophan is less tryptophan. Right. So what I love about my office is it's me and a bunch of people, and my front staff is as smart as everybody. Like that we sit at lunch for an hour. And we talk about cases, or I teach. So I throw this out there. I'm like, do you guys like, let's brainstorm this. And one of my naturopaths who's so smart, he said, well, duh, Cynthia, could we just like give her some tryptophan? I was like, I don't know why that didn't seem so obvious. I gave it to her. I saw her back 2 weeks later. You know what she said? I think this has just been a really great learning experience. I was like, what? So I removed all her meds and, you know, she went back to life. And I thought, well, that's remarkable. So then I started digging deeper and deeper. And then I started talking about it. And then later, a patient came, well, actually it was her. She came back and she just wasn't joyful. This is like maybe 9-12 months later. And I was thinking, well, if I was going to prescribe for you, I would try to tickle your dopamine. Like I'd probably give you Wellbutrin, which works on dopamine, but I wasn't going to give her meds because I'd been through that before. And so then I went to my group in, you know, at lunch and said, you guys, like now she's not making dopamine. And I was like, you know, does tryptophan? No, because it's tryptophan goes into serotonin, but tyrosine goes into epinephrine, norepinephrine, and dopamine. So I'm like sitting at lunch and one of my naturopaths says, just a second, runs into her room, comes out like 3 minutes later and shows for me the three cofactors that are shared in those two pathways. And I went, oh my gosh. And they are P5P, which is a active form of B6. BH4. That's what I meant. Sorry. Which is it's involved in methylation, and then also zinc. And it's very, very expensive to give someone BH4. So instead I cheat in and give methylfolate just to support the methylation. So that's my cheat. So I'm going to say from here on that they need folate, but it needs to be methyl, but really it's BH4, but I'm cheating. the best I can. So, and it works. So that's fine. And it's cheap, right? It's not like $100,000 a year or whatever. Right. So I gave her P5P, zinc, and methylfolate, and her joy came back. So I think what happened was, is that enterochromaffian cell is being stimulated by COVID all the time. So, and I mean, if we have time later, we can talk about how it incorporates ourselves, about how COVID incorporates itself into our microbiome. But otherwise it's just true. And, you know, every time you go to Safeway, it gets spit on you. And even if you don't catch it, right, it hits those cells and you expulse it. So there was this repetitive drain. It doesn't have to be a big COVID event, right? It probably was.
You're talking about the spike proteins getting embedded in the, like the spike proteins getting embedded, or the actual virus?
The actual virus.
Wow. Okay.
But also the spike proteins.
Is it like a latent virus, like a Lyme or an EBV? Is that a little bit what you're saying?
Right. So first with the enterochromaffian cell, it has three receptors for COVID. Now, okay. So it can also be probably stimulated just by the spike protein. But now I was talking about COVID. But to answer your acute question, is that the problem with COVID is it can do a bunch of things. So it can either incorporate itself, infect our microbiome. Rose, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So
yeah.
I mean, when I first heard her talk about the fact that it's a bacteriophage, which means that, you know, it's supposed to infect me. And then I'm supposed to decide if I want to kill that cell that has it in it, or, you know, or what, or fight or whatever. But if it's in my microbiome, well, that's self. Like, see, mm-hmm. right? I have allowed those.
Hey, folks, just a quick reminder that all of the information presented in this podcast is for information purposes only. No medical advice, no diagnosing, no treatments suggested here. Before you try anything that you hear about or learn about here, make sure that you check with your medical provider.